Hi, welcome to this week's Tech Insights. I'm your host, Brian Jackson. People are worried about the global economy. Yes, the pandemic has a lot to do with that. Anywhere COVID cases are going up, there's going to be a lot of uncertainty. But there's another big weight that's holding the economy down. It's the semiconductor supply shortage. These tiny little pieces of silicon might seem small, but they're important to so many products. The shortage has slowed down production of smartphones, laptops, video game consoles, TVs, smart appliances, and new cars. Why is this happening? Experts can point to a lot of different reasons, but consider this point made by MIT Technology Review. In 2001, the world had 25 different manufacturers that could produce the fastest chips on the market. Today, there are three manufacturers that can do it. They are Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, Intel, and Samsung. Many manufacturers don't even want the latest and greatest semiconductors. Your smart TV just doesn't need that much processing power. But no one is really looking to support that type of supply chain. Instead, you have these super consolidated supply chain players targeting a few of the biggest spenders on the market, like Apple, Qualcomm, and AMD. We last talked about this problem in April. It's only gotten worse since then, so we're going to revisit the episode today. You'll hear our guest, the president and CEO of Venture Lab, Melissa Chi. She makes the case for why it's time to focus on creating a new domestic supply chain for semiconductors. Listen in. Welcome to Tech Insights from Infotech Research Group, the podcast where a group of expert analysts cut through all the noise and focus on what really matters for technology leaders. Did you see that new Apple car that came out? Well, it's sort of the Apple car. I mean, the Wall Street Journal did this tongue-in-cheek arts and crafts project for a video that it released on April 5. The video features an iPhone that's been modified to look like a car. So it's pretty fun, but the really interesting part is the demonstration of how many components an iPhone and a car have in common. Listen to this snippet.
Introducing the Apple car.
Well, our version of the Apple car. If, you know, a car could be made out of iPhone parts. Apple's auto ambitions have been rumored for years, and we still don't know if they'll come to fruition. But what we do know is that from self-driving capabilities to running completely on battery power, cars are becoming more and more like giant gadgets. Even if you're not driving a Tesla or a new electric vehicle, there's a good chance your car is still powered, at least in part, by a computer. So, what's next in the digital car revolution?
Today, traditional auto companies need to radically change how they do business. It's very different when you look at how an electric and autonomous car is built. It is more like a computer on wheels.
The Wall Street Journal made this video to show us why it makes sense that Apple would even try to make a car. In doing so, they make another compelling point. Computer chips, or semiconductors, are ubiquitous. They are in so many different products that we use every day. Phones, cars, toys, even light bulbs. And guess what? The world is facing a chip shortage. It's causing major supply line issues and production slowdowns in various industries. Some are even calling it Chipageddon. I think that's pretty dramatic, so maybe I'll call it the silicon slowdown. No matter what you want to call it, we're talking about it here today. To help us understand where that problem is and what it means for business, we have a special guest. She's the president and the CEO of Venture Lab, which is a technology hub based in York Region, Ontario. Melissa Chi joins us. Welcome, Melissa.
Thank you very much for having me today. It's great to be here.
Welcome. And we also have an expert analyst from Infotech joining us today. John Anand is our infrastructure practice lead. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Brian. Good to be here. Melissa, very nice to meet you.
Great to meet you as well, John.
Okay, Melissa, let's start with you. Why don't you paint us a picture of this global shortage of semiconductors? What's causing this problem?
Yeah, you know, I think I'll start kind of high level, and you spoke about it in the opening, but I think when we look at what's happening, it's important to understand what these chips are, right? As you said, they're these tiny, tiny devices that are really the brains of every consumer electronic and industrial device, from, as you said, our mobile phone to our tablet and gaming consoles. They're the smarts, right, inside these electrical and traditional vehicles. And they're even inside our home appliances, right, from our thermostat to our washing machines and refrigerators. And I think, you know, what many don't understand or realize that is the immense amount of compute power that's inside of these chips. And so when you think about the fact that, you know, our mobile phones can take photographs and video at 4K and 8K resolution, there was a time not too long ago that those types of cameras were really only available to professionals. And the reason I give all of these types of this kind of background is, now you need to think about the design time for these chips, right? And the development of one of these chips can take years and before it's actually built into an end product like a mobile phone. And so that means that this life cycle is a lot longer. And the companies that need them, from the automakers to the consumer electronics folks to the mobile phone developers, they need to place their orders well in advance. And it can be in the order of 6 months in what we call a lead time, from the time that an order is placed to the receipt of that actual chip. And then add on that time that the company needs to design, build, and test those chips into end products, and you can really appreciate, I think, the full supply chain effect that we're seeing now globally. And in effect, you know, the semiconductor market is a cyclical market. So what we're seeing is really the rise and fall of a supply and demand. And what COVID-19 in the last 12 to 14 months has really done is just amplified those existing longer product cycles, as some companies reduced forecasts for orders for chips and manufacturers of other chips fulfilled those orders. And so this is a classic supply and demand challenge that we're experiencing right now. And what we're seeing is it's really impacting all sorts of industries around the world.
Okay, that's a great way to chart that problem out there. Because what I'm hearing, Melissa, is that really this is a demand-driven supply issue, that there's not a fundamental shortage of the stuff that makes semiconductors, and you know that these things do. This is a resource that has to be mined and fed into a supply chain. There's raw materials, so this isn't about a shortage of raw materials. It's just about suddenly there's a lot more demand than we're used to.
I think that's a good way to characterize it. I also do think that, you know, as I said, that was amplified by things that were not planned, obviously, by the global pandemic. So there's an increase of use of consumer electronics, for example, right? And that percolated down into the existing supply chain, so that you have chip makers who are really saying that, you know, what their forecasts were from their customers is really much more amplified than they had originally projected. And then you have other sectors, for example, as we're seeing in the auto sector, where a lot of those automakers reduced their forecast because they didn't last year anticipate that during a global pandemic that consumers would be buying cars. But we obviously saw that the trend analysis showed differently. And so, you know, that compounded with the long lead times is really what we're seeing here. And I think, you know, for us there globally, and in particular in Canada, this is while there is a shortage, I think that, you know, every kind of disruption creates a new opportunity. And so I think there is great opportunity here, but we have to navigate it carefully.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking of some other specific problems that could be in part driven by the semiconductor shortage. I'm thinking of the new NVIDIA graphic cards that come out and get snapped up in seconds after hitting the market, and the supply not able to meet the demand there. And I know those cards are very in demand for AI and even cryptocurrency mining and things like that, never mind video gaming. But then there's the PlayStation 5, right? And nobody can seem to get their hands on that, even still months after its launch. So can we think of any other issues that are sort of being caused by this semiconductor shortage? John or Melissa, throw them out there.
Well, yeah, Melissa, I'm just sort of curious, you know, same with Brian, the rise of fabless manufacturing, you know, sort of being in vogue. You're saying it's not a raw materials shortage, but it's just, you know, there's only so many of these places where chip design companies, which is what sort of a lot of North American companies are. They just sort of focus on the chip design, and then they outsource it, you know, primarily, I believe, to Taiwan and China. And that's what you're saying is causing the slowdown, the delay, because these plants just have big backlogs of orders. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's a lot of what we're seeing in the sector, right? And I think to the points that you're both making, you know, there's only so much manufacturing capacity. And if you look, you know, the major foundries or manufacturing folks are TSMC out of Taiwan, UMC out of Taiwan, all have global presence, right? And you see what's happening. You have Intel, who last week or the week before just announced that they're getting into back into the foundry business, and Samsung. So they're really, as you characterize, there are very few major semiconductor manufacturers of the actual supply, and you have many fabless and IDM integrated design manufacturers who are designing the chips. And so to answer, kind of provide a larger context of, you know, what other sectors are really going to be affected? You're seeing in consumer electronics, as you brought up the NVIDIA and the gaming systems, we're starting to see Samsung also forecast that, you know, some of the latest features that they were planning, I believe, for their latest mobile phones, they may not be in this year because they cannot get the supply out. And I think so what it means to the average consumer, you're still going to be able to get certain things. It may not be the model that you're asking for, and it may not be the full feature set that you're looking for. And so I think you're seeing some of those pent-up demands, especially as the processing power, as I was speaking about earlier, just the amount of feature-rich content and capabilities inside some of these tiny, tiny devices. If you think about what's inside an iPhone and the power that it actually has, those require advanced technologies on the manufacturing side and the design side. And there are very few companies in the world that actually have that ability to produce at that level. And so what you're seeing globally is you're seeing, you know, the big five or six semiconductor manufacturers who run these foundries investing in key locations around the world. Mm-hmm. You see, you know, there's been billions of dollars in the last 12 months announced, particularly in the U.S. Through the Chip Americas Act, as other government programs really push to attract this type of investment, because it is a very expensive endeavor to create a fab, right? It's a multi-billion dollar, depending on the technology node. But those fabs create thousands and thousands of jobs. And these are well-paying jobs, and they go across the ecosystem. And I believe SIA, the association in the U.S., forecasts that for every semiconductor job created, there are 4.89 direct and indirect jobs created in the ecosystem. And so that's a huge multiplier, right? And so those are some of the things I think that we're not just seeing in North America, but you also see major investments with the EU deciding that they want to increase their market share in the next 10 years by 2030, I believe, going from 10% of semiconductor manufacturing to 20%, which is a massive leap for the EU to make. So you're seeing a lot of this focused investment into the sector, particularly on the manufacturing side.
You're seeing that as a cyclical process, right? Because I mean, I'm in here in Canada, Brian, you know, sort of Melissa, we're all here from Canada. Many of us will remember sort of Nortel getting out of the chip manufacturing business. I believe it was in the early 2000s, if not sort of right around the turn of the millennium there. And they abandoned it because it was just sort of not cost effective. But now even the titans like Intel, you know, famous for manufacturing a lot of its own chips, you know, good facilities in Ireland, chip design out of Israel. You know, they've already turned to those traditional Taiwanese and Chinese manufacturers for the overflow. And I guess what I'm hearing you say is that there's now an appetite to bring. Is it because that the foundries are now cheaper to make? Like, what's the? Because we went over to Thailand and China because of an economy of scale, presumably. Right now, is it, you know, cheaper to make those fab plants so that we can afford to distribute that capacity and sort of scale up and down a little bit more homogeneously?
I think, you know, the global semiconductor market, I think, is a $7 trillion market from some of the reports I've read. So it's always been a globally integrated supply chain. But I think the dynamics of the past 5 years and changing demand from consumers and industry alike have created an opportunity, I think, to distribute and increase, I guess, some of that manufacturing capacity. And as they look, you know, as these foundries, I think, look as part of their strategic roadmaps to increase capacity, they are looking for strategically aligned jurisdictions where there may be some matching from government, because semiconductors are, and that technology is a matter of national security. And I think we see that more and more. And I don't believe that that it's going to be a unified, you know, integrated national supply chain. I think there's an opportunity here for key hubs around the world where there's different expertise, either on the design and the research side, but also on the manufacturing side, to really build out that capacity globally, right? I think COVID has showed us one thing, is that there are very few geographic boundaries now. And you know, changes in terms of work from home, changes in consumer behavior, I think are going to drive additional demand. And that needs to be tapered off. I think it's become, in certain technology nodes, it's become incredibly expensive, more expensive than it ever has been. So when you look at the types of chips that are needed for AI, those are at the most advanced technology nodes, right? So those are not inconsequential expenditures. You know, those fabs are going to cost, you know, $30, $40 billion, right? The ones that TSMC has announced in the U.S. are north of $15 to $20+ billion. So these are big expenditures that are required because of the processing power that is going to be required for whether it's an AI accelerator, or it's the chips that are inside the latest electric vehicle, right? 40%, I read a recent report that 40% of the electronics in a traditional vehicle, that's the cost of the car, is an electronic. So amplify that with a trend towards a greener economy, and the use of, the economies of scale of trying to transition into a net zero and net emissions economy, then you're looking at how do you make those electric vehicles and hybrid vehicles more cost effective? And there's so much electronics inside of those vehicles, right?
Yeah, that's great, Melissa. You're talking about this domestic supply chain issue that you're involved with, and we'll get into that more in a minute, but you also make the point here of the overall semiconductor market and what drives it. And I know that John has a bit of a breakdown for us, just looking at the general subsector sizes and what does the, in terms of where semiconductor markets are being consumed, I think you can just walk us through that now, John, if you have that ready.
Sure. And I mean, just sort of to a little context for what Melissa was saying. And it's really interesting because you've got, you know, sort of an awful lot, you know, sort of, you know, 40 odd percent of the market is in that data processing side. So the general Intel, you know, general purpose chips, AMD chips, those sorts of things. Then, you know, sort of the next sort of big tier of it is in communications, right? So this, you know, I'm not sure exactly what their market definitions are. Those tend to be occasionally a little bit fuzzy, but telecom stuff, you know, when it comes to manufacturing for cell phones. And then that goes into, you know, consumer electronics being at sort of about, you know, 15% of the market, which is about the same size as automotive and then industrial. So specialized chips for industrial applications from, you know, Siemens and the likes of that. And Melissa, I'm not sure if that sort of jives, you know, that's based on the research that we've been able to do. I'm not sure if that jives with sort of your understanding of the market. But the thing that I sort of take away from there is that we're moving away from that that Intel notion, you know, from long, long ago, of a single purpose chip that does a bunch of different things. And I think what I heard you say was that these manufacturing plants are you know, complicated and difficult, and you know, chip manufacturing is expensive because of the degree of specialization that each of these chips has to do. Like, there are very specific functions that they're built for. So is that What's sort of behind that trend of moving away from the general purpose chip and just sort of, you know, configuring the software to do the thing rather than have it encoded on the ASIC itself?
Yeah, it's an interesting observation, right? And I think part of it comes to as you said, just think about the types of devices that these chips are being built for. And if you look at the trends, at least with what traditionally you wouldn't have thought as chip makers, but they, you know, Apple, Google, even Facebook have mm-hmm. all made announcements, I would say, in the last 2 years to bring incredible chip expertise in-house. And that's because I think, you know, I think you see the specialization, particularly on the consumer electronics side, where you, that is the differentiator, right, of the device and the end product as they market it to the consumer. I think on the flip side, I think, you know, I think there's this notion, particularly particularly in Canada, where we talk about artificial intelligence, where we've been very focused on the software side. But as we all know, that products are made up of both hardware and software. And so the the experience and the expertise of making sure that you have the hardware that can run all those algorithms mm-hmm. is critically important, right? And that, in fact, is the differentiator, because a lot of the, you know, there's been incredible research in the last 20 years on AI and machine learning. But to unleash the power of those algorithms requires advanced computing infrastructure. And so that is 150% of course on the hardware side, right? Which is driven by chip technology. So I think you are seeing trends to deeper specialization. I also think that is still opportunity for, there's been an emergence of sensor technology, right? Which is not pure semiconductor per se, but that's certainly a growing market. In terms of the types of sensors that are going to be developed. I mean, we saw it through COVID. One of the biggest challenges was a simple sensor inside a ventilator that people can get a hold of, right? Mm-hmm. And I think you see that now, you know, what many people don't realize is that same sensor is actually used in IoT and automotive devices. So just think about the magnification of those types of devices or those types of electronic components that actually are pervasive in multiple sectors, right? So I do think there's still applicability across multiple sectors. It depends on, I would say, the deep application of the end product that you're building for. I think there's still a mix.
And Melissa, you were talking there about the need to create the domestic supply chain. And earlier you made reference to some of the build out of that in the U.S. We've seen the Semiconductor Industry Association that's based in the U.S. calling that federal government to create incentives to encourage more domestic production of semiconductors. And you're involved here, Melissa, in Canada, in a bit of this effort north of the border as well. So can you just tell us a bit about the project that you're involved with and this idea that we need to increase the domestic production of semiconductors here?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, our team, as many may or may not know, we're a leading group of entrepreneurs. So we've all walked in the shoes of our founders. And so in 2020, we launched the Hardware Catalyst Initiative. And that is Canada's first and only state-of-the-art lab and incubator exclusively focused on founders who are building hardware and semiconductor companies. And, you know, through this very short period of time, we really emerged as Canada's hardware hub, attracting more than $50 million from industry that really matches at a 5x multiplier the nearly $9.7 million that the Government of Canada through FedDev Ontario has invested into the lab, into the initiative. And that really, for everyone who's listening, was really born out of our team's collective experience working in the semiconductor and the tech industry for most of our business lives. And so some of the challenges that are faced by Canadian founders in this sector, and this was my own personal experience, is the longer design time, the sales cycles, and the capital intensiveness of having to download that software and get access to very specialized equipment, and only needing that specialized equipment when you actually have a working prototype of a chip that, you know, you had to ship overseas to mm-hmm. tape out and manufacture and then figure out whether when it came back, is it actually working? And so this state-of-the-art lab is the first time that Canadian founders, particularly in this domain, have access to all of those very expensive resources, right? These tools are multi-million dollars for one single company. And we're, you know, through the Hardware Castle Initiative, the founders that we select and the companies we select to bring through actually have not only access to the tools and the resources, but to this entire community of manufacturing and technology expertise of veterans, frankly, who have done this before and scaled companies in this domain from Canada and gone global. So that's kind of where we started. And, you know, I think building on that, we have this national ecosystem of organizations who are working in different areas, from research to design to I would say early stage prototyping and production. We have a really solid base, I would say, of organizations doing that. And so to me, you know, I think that it is very important for Canada to emerge through this crisis. And
the government is supporting you in that regard to some degree with that FedDev funding announcement that you had as well, right, Melissa?
That's right. That's right. So FedDev, as I said, the government of Canada invested $9.7 million, most recently $4.7 million, to expand the capabilities of the lab. And that allows us to virtualize across Canada. And so, you know, I think Canada has a real opportunity to strengthen our supply chain resiliency. And I think, you know, from it really starts from all of those aspects, research, development, design, and manufacturing. And I think Canada has an opportunity to be one of those places, and that we will emerge as one of those places that you will see, you know, investment for semiconductor manufacturing, right, as we go forward. I believe that Canada doesn't have a choice to really be at the forefront of innovation as we have been before, right? And we are a perfect location because we have the talent, we have the skills, we have the capacity, and we have a very stable infrastructure, which are all the right ingredients to make sure that we are one of those global hubs for semiconductor development and manufacturing.
That's interesting to think that semiconductors could possibly drive a sort of a new manufacturing interest in Canada and even elsewhere. So that's the time we really have for today, Melissa. I want to thank you for joining us and talking through this issue and how you're involved with it and the ways that you think that we can solve the problem too. So thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure to speak to you both.
And John, thanks so much for joining us today as well.
Quite welcome. Pleasure to be on the show with you, Melissa. Everyone, take care.
And for our listeners, thanks for tuning in again. Remember, every Monday morning, you'll get a new episode of Tech Insights. But you have to subscribe or follow us on Apple Podcasts. We're also available on Spotify and on Google Podcasts. Really, wherever you want podcasts, you can get Tech Insights. I'm Brian Jackson.